You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hi, I'm Kendra Winchester, here with Autumn Privet, and this is the Reading Women podcast, where we are reclaiming half the bookshelf by talking about books by or about women. And today we have Christine Hung Oak Lee with us, and she has recently written Tell Me Everything You Don't Remember. And so we're going to chat with her today about her book, about women in writing, and everything. So welcome to the podcast, Christine.
Thank you for having me.
We're so excited to have you here. We've been looking forward to this for so long.
Sorry, as a writer, we're like, it feels unreal. So of course my response is a giggle. I'm like, but that's what happens when your debut memoir comes out. It seems unreal to you. Like, oh, okay. That's been my whole week.
I can imagine, like, it's been a huge press week, right?
It has been. It's been super exciting. I can't complain, but it's, you know, I'm this massive introvert and suddenly I'm out in the world and talking about myself and my book and making sure I'm smiling while I do it.
We're both introverts doing this thing, so we feel you 100%, man. So I guess to start off with, for those of our listeners who haven't read the book, could you just describe it and we'll go from there?
Sure. Tell Me Everything You Don't Remember is about the stroke I had at the age of 33. It was a left thalamic stroke, and it was caused by a clot that went through a birth defect in my heart instead of being filtered out through the lungs. So what it does is it takes the reader from the moment of the stroke and back and forth in time as I seek and find my memory again throughout recovery, and in doing so, touches upon the themes of rebirth, literal birth, and also finding a new self and moving forward from this trauma.
That's one thing that really struck me as I was reading the book is how the structure, I felt like, captured very well, like, your recovery process. Like, as you were telling it, like, I really felt like I was engaging with your recovery.
Yeah, and you're speaking of the sort of Slaughterhouse Five reference, or just the overall traveling through time?
For me, it was more so just, like, the traveling through time, but definitely, like, I thought that the Slaughterhouse Five really underscored that whole feeling that you were trying to evoke.
Yeah, I tried to figure out what the structure of this memoir was going to be. It was really hard for me, the fact that I had to write this memoir based on things I could remember from what I'd written in journals. So my memory was not this clean sweep of and then and then and then and then and then. And then there were these major gaps I had from when I didn't write down what had happened. And I don't, my memory doesn't naturally remember it as one long narrative. So there was that. And then there was the fact that, you know, I was writing about memory and I was writing about the brain. And I also just didn't want to write about myself all the time. It felt awkward. So it was a conscious decision to include science in the narrative. That was part of the structural decision. So I knew that there would be chapters focused on the scientific aspects of my stroke. And then around the time I started writing the memoir, I went back and read Slaughterhouse Five. In the memoir, Slaughterhouse Five, and in real life, Slaughterhouse Five was a book I was reading, quote unquote, reading at the time of my stroke. And I didn't realize at the time of my stroke that I wasn't remembering a single word I was reading. So what I did was went back and read the book for the first time. And it was while reading the book that I began to understand Billy Pilgrim's travels through time and feel a connection to that feeling of confusion and, you know, disorientation. And so I adopted that structure into the memoir itself.
It's gorgeous. The structure, oh my goodness. Like, I actually like Slaughterhouse 5 better now because I've read your book before. It was like, eh, but now I'm like, oh my goodness, it's like Christine's book.
Oh, yeah, that's a super compliment. I'm like, I made that I can't imagine making Vonnegut better, but thank you.
Autumn and I read it in grad school, and so we kind of really geek out over all the references in there.
It was one of some of my worries. I was like, I don't know if everybody's read Slaughterhouse 5. So when I was writing it, I had to make sure that it could stand for readers who hadn't yet read Slaughterhouse 5 too.
And I definitely can tell that, like, I didn't remember all the details from when I read Slaughterhouse 5, but as you're describing it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's how that happened and how that went. So, and I actually recommended it to my spouse because he loves Slaughterhouse 5. And I was like, you have to read this memoir. And she uses Slaughterhouse 5. He's like, oh, I think I might actually read that. So,
yeah, we're always recommending Josh all these random books in the podcast. So, poor man. His TBR is like hundreds of books long now.
Being told what to read could be a lot worse. Life could be a lot worse than getting book recommendations.
It's very, very true. So, in addition to the structure, we also wanted to, when I read it, I kind of geeked out because your recovery also kind of imitates the birth of a new person. And you discuss like your recovery in terms of a child developing. You've talked about in other interviews and such, like how you recovered, you had to learn a new way to do things. Your brain had to basically find a way around part that died from the stroke. So at the time, did you realize that you were a new person? But did you realize that in hindsight, or just how did that come about?
Yeah, I think that we kind of become this new person even after dealing with flu. You know, you kind of go through it and go, oh, you know, I feel better. I feel like a new person again. That's that actual phrase. I didn't come to terms with the fact that this is all leading to my becoming a new person until long after I'd recovered. And by that, I mean years after. Part of my recovery consisted of becoming very depressed, because my goal was to be back to the old person and be recovered. I feel like that's actually even the meaning of the word recover, right? Mm. Means to go back and get what you had. I was in that state of mind, and there's just no way I was going to become that old self again. There's just no way that I would be able to pick up every skill that I'd had before. And I became very depressed because I kept mourning that self and fighting to have that back. And of course, that just amplified my sense of loss. You know, it wasn't until years later that I realized I'm a new self. This is a new me. I have new skills that often offset the skills I've lost. That was very healing too. But it was just something I slowly pieced together. At the point of recovery, I basically went, well, I guess I'm as back as I'll ever be, and this is good enough. But it wasn't until much later that I had a feeling of, you know, that I really felt like, oh, you know, that I had an explanation of what I'd become.
I think that's really interesting with the brain, and you described a lot of the science about how you recovered and how your brain finds a new way to function. And I've heard that like your personality is basically how your brain has figured out how to function. As you're reading, I could see that, like you talked about your emotions and how you could not lie and just the different things and how your brain had just changed the way it functioned. And I just thought it was really beautiful how like you had like the birth imagery and the child imagery, and just my writer self geeked out like majorly. I'm just sitting there like underlining everything.
Here I go again with the giggles. I'm horrible with compliments. I love compliments, but I'm horrible with compliments. Because my dad and, you know, I'm a child of immigrants. So there's always this like, okay, good job. Keep doing better. You know, you got an A. Why didn't you get an A+? So it's a very strange experience for me to experience compliments. Thank you. I'm being taught to say thank you so much.
You're perfectly fine. So one of the other things that you talked about in your, like, related to recovery was you know, mourning the person you once were, you know, including your husband, who's your primary caregiver at that time. And like, so how did you see like the stages of grief manifest themselves like during your recovery?
Yeah. What are they? The stages are denial, bargaining, anger, depression, acceptance, right? I'm not sure if they're in that order. Oftentimes, and I don't feel like I need to put them in exact order, because I think people's grieving process isn't always in that stated order. So, of course, there was the denial. I didn't go to the hospital when I had my stroke. I just couldn't possibly fathom that I'd had a stroke. Of course, there was a denial that was amplified by my memory loss, because I couldn't remember what had happened to me. So I kept having to ask over and over again what had happened. And I think for me, you know, bargaining came long after anger. I just got very angry about, by the time, I mean, I was in this blissful state. I was in this zen state when I had a 15-minute short-term memory. Because when you don't have a short-term memory, you can't worry and you can't plan. You don't hold any grudges. It's very peaceful. It's hell on earth for everyone else around you. But for me, it was just this very peaceful state of mind. But when I got better, I started remembering what I couldn't do. And I had this very long year of slipping between anger and depression. You know, I just kept being either angry about not being able to do the things I wanted to do, and then being depressed because I couldn't do them, which then turned into bargaining, where I was like, you know, basically decided that if I could, you know, I had to really figure out what was most important to me. And I remember making a bargain, saying, well, the one thing I want back is my writing. So if I just work very hard, maybe everything else will come back. And then of course, the acceptance, you know, even before I was all the way better, you know, my doctors had told me that that was as far as they could take me. And I still wasn't able to read anything beyond a short story. I still wasn't able to balance a checkbook. I try to add, but, you know, I remember Adam at the time going, honey, just what did you do to the bank account? And I said, what do you mean? And I just subtracted it and added. And he's like, no, this is not math. What you did is not math. And I'm like, yes, it is. And it all made sense in my head. But he's just like, no, this checkbook is not balancing out. And so he took the checkbook away from me. And in hindsight, of course, Adam must have been in denial too, because who gives somebody who just had a stroke and can't remember anything the checkbook? So he was going through his own cycle too. I finally reached acceptance. I was like, all right, well, I guess if this is as good as it gets. And then I think there's an added step to depression when somebody gets very ill, is then there's the PTSD that comes. You just get these triggers like, oh my God, what will happen? What if it happens again? Because, they figured out what the root cause was, but they hadn't gone and immediately fixed the hole in my heart. Because it was not the most common thing to do back then. And of course, you know, that's all. You need insurance approval, and insurance companies don't always want to approve that procedure. So,
yeah.
And then I did have another one. So then that hole got closed.
Kind of a related question. Like, do you think like naming or acknowledging like the phase that you were in helped lead to your recovery? Because I think about the passages when you were talking about, you know, your childhood and these feelings that you had been denying or, you know, not acknowledging. Do you think that was a byproduct of your recovery or helped like progress your recovery?
It was very liberating to learn that what I was experiencing was grief. I blogged anonymously throughout the span of my stroke, including that very, very first day. It was at jadepark.wordpress.com. And so I made a number of friends on that blog, because I would just, even if it was nonsense, I was blogging with the intention of recording everything for posterity under the safety of being, you know, nameless, and also with the hope that it was an exercise in writing. And somebody said, have you thought about whether maybe what you're feeling is a grieving process? And it was completely enlightening and liberating to realize what I was going through was something that I had to go through. And once I realized that it was a part of a process, then I was able to let go and stop resisting these stages and these floods of feeling and these reactions to what was happening.
I appreciate how you talked about in your book how you wrote the BuzzFeed article and how, like, the process, not just of grieving, but how that reflected in your writing. And a writing teacher in college always said, you know, emotion drives a lot of what you write, but if you write too soon, you're just going to emotionally vomit, like, all over the page. It's going to be, like, horrible. That's an awful image, but it stuck with me. And it, you know, I just thought of that immediately when you talked about how you had to wait for time to pass to write the book and to write your story, and you knew you needed to do it. Can you, like, describe the stages of that, like how that reflected in your recovery and the different attempts that you might have made to write your story?
Yes, it took me a long time to be able to write about my stroke. I knew that I would eventually write about my stroke, but I had no idea that I'd have to wait nearly 10 years to do so. I did a lot of therapeutic writing throughout my stroke. I did a lot of therapeutic writing after my stroke. I didn't talk, I didn't discuss it very much with my, my friends and people I had just become friends with. To the extent that when I wrote the BuzzFeed essay in 2014, a lot of people were stunned because they didn't realize I'd had a stroke, because I was processing it all those years. I think part of nonfiction is taking a personal, particular experience and then writing outward and making it universal. And that universality wasn't there in my writing until I went through a new trauma in 2013. And it was in 2013 that I saw the stroke as a source of lessons and not just pain. It was in 2013 that I had a baby and postpartum depression, and my husband had just left me, and he and I had been together for 18 years, that I could truly understand the stroke and write about it in a way that was edifying for others, because it was finally edifying for me. I finally could see it as a whole. I could finally see the lessons learned and how they all connected. I was trying to learn lessons throughout, but I just, you know, didn't see how they all connected in one narrative until then. And then I was very fortunate to be asked by BuzzFeed to write an essay about that experience. I was stunned at the response, but I think that it was because I waited.
Yeah, it's definitely beautiful. One question I did want to follow up was, you talk a lot about how when you would describe your experience to people, and you just mentioned, you know, people didn't even realize that, I mean, you know, having a stroke at 33 is incredibly rare. And a lot of people were like, well, you don't look sick, or you don't look like you have a stroke. How did that affect your, like, emotional recovery? Like, when you would talk to people, and it's almost like you have to, like, bring up evidence of, well, I actually did have it because of X, Y, and Z. And can you just talk about that relation with people and your experience?
It had some really big upsides and really big downsides. You know, on the upside, I could pass as normal if I wanted to. I didn't really have any physical manifestations in my body after the stroke. On the downside, I was severely limited. And every time I had to tell people about my invisible disability, I had to explain and validate my position. I became very resentful for having to do so, to the extent that I wrote up these little cards that I, like, passed around to people saying, please be patient with me. And then that backfired, because then people were overly obsequious. It was very enlightening for me, because when I became a teacher, it helped me understand my students with learning disabilities and what they have to navigate, and the fact that they have to explain themselves every single time, and that they navigate the world in a slightly different way. I think that was a very challenging part of recovery. I didn't know at which point, you know, like, and then after a while, and I was, you know, better enough, you know, I chose never to really talk about the stroke again as part of introductions, unless it came up specifically, because I had gotten so sick by that point of having to explain myself. And so that explain, you know, for me, that's, a lot of why I never told people I had a, you know, all the people I met after 2008, very few of them had knew that I'd had a stroke because I'd by that point gotten so sick of telling people and having to explain myself.
It's very emotionally exhausting.
It is. It is. And, you know, I didn't, the left thalamus does a lot of self-soothing. It doesn't really get fully developed until you're almost 2 years old as a human being. And it's why babies, you know, even if you tell them mom's going to be right back, they still freak out. It's because they don't have that soothing capability. So I was not a pleasant sick person. I was a rat. So when people, when I felt emotionally burdened, I would have a meltdown just like a toddler. You know, apologies to all the pharmacy techs who had to deal with me for my medicine at that time, because if I had to wait a little longer, I'd have a meltdown and start crying.
That's one reason I really appreciated your perspective, because I think it's easy to empathize with people who, you know, have a broken arm or some kind of visible kind of illness. But if you can't see it, it is harder. Unless you actually like get inside their head, it is harder to kind of understand what they're going through, unless you've experienced it yourself too.
Yeah. And if you're 33 and all your friends are in their early 30s, you know, it's hard to expect people to truly understand. It's like being the first friend who gets divorced, you know?
Yeah.
You're like, oh crap. Nobody, everybody else is married. You know, I don't have anywhere to go. You know, I have to go. I'm totally, you know, totally single now and everyone's like lovey-dovey. You know, and so being out of sync with everyone.
So to switch gears just a little bit, so our podcast is about, you know, books written by women or about women. From your perspective, like, we kind of wanted to ask you, like, what you thought about the importance of having female voices in writing and in literature, and if and how that influenced the writing of this memoir, the people that you were inspired by.
Absolutely. I have spent almost my entire, like a vast majority of my life taking care of men. My dad, you know, seriously, he raised me to be the perfect girl. He's like, you know, he would always say, men don't like that if you do it that way. You know, if you have, you know, if you just get really stubborn, you're just never going to find a husband. And that was literally the filter with which he raised me, to the point where I just am a guy's kind of gal on the exterior. And it wasn't until I went to grad school for my MFA at Mills College that this all started to shift, because until then I'd also been in tech, which is predominantly male. You go into a meeting, it's all males, built around male culture. And so Mills College is a small liberal arts college, and it's a women's small liberal arts college. The graduate school is co-ed. It's a small minority, you know, like there are no men on campus. And it takes a special kind of man to apply to a women's college for grad school.
Definitely.
And so the graduate school is very informed by that undergraduate cultural identity of being a women's school. Most of my workshops were female. Like there were maybe one or two men in my MFA workshop. It was a total cultural shift for me to be in an environment where women's voices were predominant, where the female voice, you know, took precedence and was the perspective of much of the feedback and instruction. This is the framework in which I started a writing life. At times, I found it very strange because I just come from this world, was all about dudes, but it, in hindsight, was incredibly formative to me. And when I was writing my memoir, I had to really work hard to not let Adam's perspective get into my narrative. You think that when you write a memoir, it's like, it's my memoir. But given the way I was raised, you know, it's very easy for me to be like, well, what does that guy think? But it was my experience in the MFA program at Mills. It was my experience as a new mother to a daughter that really helped me listen to my own voice. And, you know, that informed the writing of the memoir. And, you know, I was just basically alone that year in 2014 and part of 2014 and 15 as I wrote this memoir. And I was surrounded by women. I was just, you know, I was a new mom. I had a daughter. I had babysitters. They were women. I, you know, my doulas would visit me. They were women. So I felt like I was in this incredible new space, fortified by women and informed by women, fed by women, led by women, held by women. You know, I hope that force shows in this memoir.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, that's one thing that really struck me was just how powerful your voice is on its own and not supported, propped up by male characters or from, as you were saying, like not too much from your husband's perspective. But, and that's one reason I think you really strongly resonated with us is like, we both went to schools where women's voices weren't prized as much. So we definitely are attracted to these strong female voices. Very refreshing.
You know, every time I go to AWP, I don't know if you're familiar with AWP, that big writers conference with all the MSA programs there. I'm like, where are all these guys from? Because my MFA was almost all women. Like, whoa, tripped out. Who knew that there are this many MFA, you know, guys in the MFA program? Because that's, for me, my experience was it was just completely female dominant, which I love that I, and, you know, I also went to Hedgebrook, the writing residency for women and, around, you know, focused on the female voice. So, it's, I think, you know, there is like a subconscious drive to, mitigate my upbringing and, my 20 somethings where I immersed myself in the male code.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons why we started about this podcast, because in our English major, it was all, you know, we called dead white males. So we wanted a larger, not just, you know, women, but a larger diversity audience as well. And one of those things is, you know, people with chronic illnesses. And I have a chronic illness, so I'm really passionate about promoting voices in chronic illness. And there aren't many. Like, I can think of Laura Hillenbrand. You know, she writes with chronic illness. That's about it. So one of the things I wanted to ask you was, where did you get your inspiration for, if you got any, other women writers with chronic illness to look to as you were, you know, telling your story?
Yeah, there aren't a lot of those memoirs, and there aren't a lot of memoirs by writers of color either. You know, certainly there's, you know, James Baldwin. There's also... You know, there's, and in terms of traumatic brain injury, there's Brain on Fire by Suzanne Cahalan. But, you know, there's just not a lot of chronic illness memoirs. But, you know, I've always been doing my own thing. I think I identify as a writer of color first before I identify as a writer of chronic illness. I feel like everything I do is going to be a pioneering event on one level or another. You know, and I think each and every one of us is a pioneer, regardless of precedent, because as artists, we have to find a new perspective on each and every single new thing that happens to us. And we're adding to the spectrum of voices out there. And some of us are going to be farther out on the ledge than others. But that's our duty as artists, is to put out a new perspective, something that no one else has heard before. Now, I always struggle to find previous examples of the kind of writing or storytelling I do. I write because no one else is telling the stories that I want to read. So, you know, we have to be brave. We have to be brave and courageous and tell our truth, even if we're the only one doing it. And, you know, put our work out there.
Writing is hard. Like, it's harder than I think people think it is.
Oh my gosh. I had a friend once tell me, Christine, if work, he was like this really fit man. He's like, if working out were easy, everybody would do it. Everybody would be in shape. And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I'm like, well, if writing a book were easy, everybody would do it. It changes my mind. I remember the last word I put down and I was like, my brain is just completely smoking. It changes your whole mind to have completed a book. Just this marathon, you know, like it's like running a marathon, just even training for it. It changes you.
Are you working on anything right now, or are you taking a break from your marathon?
I am.
I am writing my novel next. I'm trying to finish up my novel, The Golem of Soul, and it's supposed to be out in 2018 by Echo HarperCollins. And then I'm working on another book proposal, possibly another memoir. I feel like my novel, people are asking me if I have a part two to this story. And I'm like, well, the novel is kind of part two. Because as you know, in this memoir, I'm trying to get back to my writing. And when I do get back to my writing, it's this novel to which I return. So the novel, in a sense, is part two of this whole saga. And I can't wait to return to it. I'm a little bit on break right now because I'm helping out with I'm birthing this book into the universe. And as anybody who's given birth knows, you can't really pay attention to anything else while you do it. But yeah, that's what I'm working on next. And I'm very excited about it. It's about a guy who immigrates to America in 1972 looking for his long lost daughter who builds a golem to find her. And it's a cross-cultural retelling of an old tale.
I'm so excited right now. Like, I had to stop myself from going to like my list of the giant list of all things, like add this book now. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that is, oh man. Okay. I'm just going to have to stop geeking out and breathe. So I think that's all of our questions today and all the time we have, but thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I love podcasts. You guys saved my life when I have long commutes.
Thank you so much, and we're so excited to have you on. And so I guess I'll do the outro now. So that's our show, and next month we will return to our regularly scheduled podcasting program. And in the meanwhile, you can find me, Autumn Privet, on Twitter and Litzy and Instagram, and Kendra at Katie Winchester. And we'll put some links in our podcast notes about places where you can keep up with Christine and her news and releases about her new book. And thank you all so much for listening.
We'll talk to you later, guys.